This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, November 24th, 2009. From New York City, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, opposition grows to Obama's expected announcement of a troop increase in Afghanistan. Sri Lankans begin an unsteady road to peace. And we'll go to a cafe in Portland that is drawing national attention for serving medical marijuana. Those stories and more, right after the headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Chinese authorities executed two men today. They were convicted of selling melamine-laced milk and for endangering public safety. From Beijing, Shukwa Cheng.
Zhang Yujun and Geng Jinping were the two men found responsible for producing and selling the melamine dairy products. Their death sentences were carried out today. Last year, six children died and 300,000 people became sick after drinking the contaminated milk. A global recall of many Chinese dairy products was also issued. Melamine is a chemical used in plastics and fertilizers. Mr. Zhang and Mr. Geng used it to fool inspectors into thinking that the milk was high in protein. Instead, the chemical caused kidney stones, kidney failure, and other health problems. 19 other people were sentenced to prison terms in the milk scandal. Tian Wenhua was one of them. She was the chairwoman of Sanlu, one of the major dairy companies involved and one of China's biggest suppliers of milk powder before they filed for bankruptcy. She's been sentenced to life in prison. Since the scandal, the government has ordered 22 firms to pay a total of 161 million US to the families involved. But many are refusing the offers, saying that more public investigation needs to be made. Shukwa Cheng, FSRN, Beijing.
According to a report published in The Nation magazine today, employees of Blackwater, now known as Z Services and U.S. Training Center, are part of covert on-the-ground U.S. military operations in Pakistan. Citing three anonymous sources, investigative reporter Jeremy Scahill writes that Blackwater operatives plan targeted assassinations of suspected Taliban and Al-Qaeda operatives and snatch and grabs of high-value targets. Further, the article claims that Blackwater is also employed by the Pakistani government as a subcontractor and in that capacity works alongside local forces in counterterrorism operations, including house raids and border interdictions. A spokesperson for the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff refused to discuss the matter, saying they do not comment on current operations one way or the other. An entire family was killed in eastern Afghanistan today, including a one-year-old child. Mujahid Jawad is in Kabul.
The family of six, two adults and four children, were killed when the bomb exploded in the eastern province of Khost. Muhammad Yaqub, an official of the Khost police headquarters, told FSRN that three members of the family were killed on the spot and three others died from their injuries in the hospital. He said the roadside bomb destroyed their car while traveling from their home to the city, adding that one of the children was an infant, another was 8 years old. A relative said that they were on their way to shop in preparation for the upcoming Eid holiday. He added that all the victims were the relatives of a former mayor of Khost province, who also was killed in the same place by another bomb explosion last year. Yaqub said that they are aggressively searching for perpetrators. No one has yet claimed responsibility for the attack. Mujahid Jawad, FSRN, Kabul.
Britain officially opened an inquiry into the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq, the war, and its aftermath. Sir John Chilcott opened the investigation.
We need to establish what happened, and we are piecing this together from the evidence we are collecting from documents or from those who have first-hand experience. We will then need to evaluate what went well and what didn't, and crucially, why.
Senior British diplomats testified today. Sir Peter Ricketts, then chair of Britain's Joint Intelligence Committee, said there was no one in the UK government in early 2001 advocating a regime change and that it was assumed that it was not British policy to seek the removal of Saddam Hussein. The panel will hear testimony from on-the-ground operatives as well as high-level politicians, including Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. A final report isn't expected until late 2010 at the earliest. At the International Criminal Court at The Hague today, two militia leaders from the Congo pleaded not guilty. The two are charged with crimes against humanity and war crimes, including murder, rape, and sexual enslavement carried out in the village of Bogoro in 2003. Jermaine Katanga and Matthew Ngajolo claim that Ugandan forces committed the atrocities. 200 men, women, and children were killed in the massacre, some burned in their sleep, others shot and then hacked with machetes to retrieve the bullets. And in Buenos Aires, another major human rights trial opened today. Free Speech Radio News' Marie Trigona was there.
17 former police and military officers face charges of human rights abuses and forcefully disappearing people detained during the nation's military dictatorship from 1976 to 1983. The 180 victims at the center of this trial were held in a series of illegal detention centers operated under the junta's command. Many were tortured, drugged, and then thrown from airplanes into the sea. Hijos is a group of children of the disappeared. They were among the human rights observers outside the court today.
I'm Ramiro Posse. I have a father who has disappeared. He was kidnapped and taken to Olimpo, one of the three clandestine detention centers being investigated in the trial, which begins today.
More than 400 will testify in this trial, expected to last 8 months. It is estimated that 30,000 people were disappeared during the nation's bloody military junta. Marie Trigona, FSRN, Buenos Aires.
For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. Philippine President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo declared a state of emergency today after more bodies were discovered in what's being called the Maguindanao Massacre. Police found 24 more bodies today in the rural village of Saniag on the southern island of Mindanao. This brings the death toll to 46, and investigators say some bodies showed signs of mutilation. On Monday, gunmen abducted more than 40 people, including the wife and relatives of Ismael Mangudadatu, a vice mayor running for governor of Maguindanao. They were traveling to the provincial capital to file nomination papers for Mangudadatu, who was not with the group. At least a dozen journalists were also killed. Sam Trudeau is the New York representative for Reporters Without Borders.
Journalists in the Philippines are in a state of shock right now, and we hope the government will take concrete steps to find those responsible for the murders, but also those who organized the murders.
Some 300 journalists and their colleagues protested the murders in Manila and southern Davao City. Macapagal Arroyo ordered both the armed forces and the national police to begin an immediate pursuit of the attackers. But some local politicians are demanding that authorities do more, including detaining and questioning Maguindanao Governor Andal Ampatuan Sr., the head of a powerful family that's been a political ally of the president. Senate Minority Leader Aquilino Pimentel Jr. spoke to local media outlet ABS-CBN News.
How can he avoid being investigated in connection with the murder when the men who supposedly perpetrated the killing were militia men under his employ? That's what I heard. And if that is true, then certainly, at the very least, Andal is a material witness.
The governor's son, Andal Ampatuan Jr., is running for governor to succeed his father. Authorities are investigating a number of local police, including one who was reportedly seen with the gunman and pro-government militiamen. Media reports suggest that President Obama will soon announce sending an additional 34,000 troops to Afghanistan. He could make that announcement as early as next week. Opponents to an expanded war in Afghanistan are launching a campaign urging Congress to reject Obama's request. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
At a White House news conference with Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh, President Obama was asked about news reports revealing a troop increase to Afghanistan. Obama said an announcement will be made soon, but after Thanksgiving. He also said the review has been, quote, comprehensive and useful.
After 8 years, some of those years in which we did not have, I think, either the resources or the strategy to get the job done, it is my intention to finish the job.
The president is expected to increase troops by 34,000, a plan that could cost tens of billions of dollars. That would bring the total number of U.S. troops to about 100,000. If the president does increase troops, he would do so despite the concerns of Vice President Joe Biden and the ambassador to Afghanistan, Carl Eikenberry, who used to be a military commander there. But Obama's current military chiefs, Stanley McChrystal and David Petraeus, have said at least 40,000 troops are necessary to stem the rise of the Taliban.
He's the president, he's the commander-in-chief, and he must make hard decisions. Instead, he's opted for the weak compromise. He's capitulated.
Retired Colonel Douglas MacGregor served during the first Iraq War. He's come out strongly against both the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. He says Afghanistan's history has proven it cannot be fixed.
I think that we will simply wallow in this quagmire. We will waste blood and treasure. We will accomplish nothing. Matters will get worse.
More than 900 U.S. military members have died in Afghanistan. The price tag is rising as well. According to the National Priorities Project, the U.S. has spent $230 billion, more than a quarter of that spent in 2009 alone. To block any possible troop increase, peace groups are turning their attention to Congress.
The bottom line really is going to be the bottom line.
That was Tom Andrews, former member of Congress from Maine and current president of the Win Without War Coalition. He says a targeted campaign to focus on members of Congress will urge them to oppose any additional funding for more troops.
The president can't escalate if he doesn't have the money, and the Congress is responsible for making that decision.
Peace groups might find some allies in Congress. Some Democrats have already expressed opposition. Progressive members have vowed to block a troop increase. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi previously said the president should not expect a shadow Congress. And gatekeeper of the money, Appropriations Chair David Obey, proposed a tax on the wealthiest Americans to pay for a troop increase. But the president might turn to unlikely allies. Republicans have largely expressed support for an escalation in the war. Support Obama could find necessary to carry out a troop surge. Obama could announce his plans as early as Tuesday. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
Next week, officials for the World Trade Organization are scheduled to meet in Geneva. It's the first time in nearly 4 years that the ministerial body has been able to convene. On the official agenda is agricultural issues and trade agreements, but activists say that the expansion of the WTO is also on the table. That's what was at stake in Seattle in 1999 when a coalition of environmentalists, labor, and human rights activists first brought the WTO to worldwide attention. We're now joined by Lori Wallach. She's the director of Global Trade Watch, a division of the consumer and environmental advocacy group Public Citizen. The group was one of the principal organizers of the actions in Seattle in 1999. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you.
You've written that the WTO extends well beyond trade deals and policies into many different social aspects, whether it's food safety or health care in countries across the globe. Let's begin with how policies of the WTO are connected to the current financial crisis.
Well, one of the elements that most people don't realize is even part of WTO is an agreement called the General Agreement on Trade and Services, and that agreement covers financial services. And that agreement explicitly forbids whole categories of regulation for any banking, securities, derivatives, insurance, policy area that's submitted to the agreement. Well, the U.S. submitted everything. So we literally agreed to get rid of some of the New Deal key banking regulatory safeguards like Glass-Steagall in our WTO commitments. So right now, we got into this mess in part because of this deregulation, extreme deregulation model being exported from the U.S. and EU banks who pushed it and got our governments to do this in the 90s. It got exported to 100 additional countries through WTO, and now we're all locked in. So it's not just part of the cause, but it's also an impediment to restoring financial stability.
So turning to the current meeting in Geneva, what is being discussed and what is at stake?
Well, you know, the WTO is supposed to have a, what they call a ministerial conference, a meeting of the minister level, the highest level trade officials every 2 years. And the myth is that this is the governing body of the WTO. It's what gives its legitimacy. Well, the WTO expansion agenda called the Doha Round Negotiations, which, by the way, is the same agenda that the whole world rejected at Seattle, because while there were great protests on the streets during Seattle 10 years ago, the revolution in the negotiating suites was similarly amazing, in that countries stood up and said no. The majority of countries refused to accept a huge expansion of the WTO's scope and powers. And so that agenda was then repackaged, and after 9/11 and the shaky political context, the U.S. coerced countries into agreeing. But a couple years after that, at the Cancun WTO ministerial, the ministerial blew up again because no one wanted WTO expansion except for a handful of very powerful but few countries. So that battle continues, and it's been so contested, this space, that for 4 years they have not been able to have a WTO ministerial because they were afraid if they got together there'd be another high-profile explosion, protest, blow-up, and the WTO might just go with it.
And these are coming from the countries who are members of the organization.
On the inside, there are a lot of countries that are very furious with the agenda. On the outside, in literally 100 countries, there are now pretty much permanent campaigns on the governments not to cave in and do this damaging WTO expansion. Part of our mission now is to get the Obama administration to conform its WTO agenda by dropping the old Bush agenda that's still standing in as the U.S. position and conforming our agenda to the commitments President Obama made during the campaign to reform the rules of the global economy, quote, so they work for all of us, not just a few special interests.
And we're just about out of time, but speak for a moment about the Trade Act and what would it do and where is it right now? Where does it stand?
Well, the Trade Act is really like a roadmap for WTO turnaround. It calls for the renegotiation of WTO and lays out a model of what a good trade agreement would be in the future, what needs to be done to fix the WTO, and a new method to negotiate trade agreements that has more accountability and is more open to public oversight. And I'm really excited to say that just this morning, the 130th co-sponsor signed on to the Trade Act. That means it's too short from having a majority of Democrats in the House of Representatives, and the Senate version of the bill is going into Congress next week. So it's really gotten a very impressive, broad array of support, and it is a roadmap for reform and turnaround.
We've been speaking with Lori Wallach, Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, about the WTO meeting in Geneva next week. It's scheduled to begin on November 30th, exactly 10 years to the day of the protests in Seattle. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Think segregated schools are a thing of the past? Think again.
We are now at a level of segregation for black students that we last saw in the 1960s. All of our progress since that time has been obliterated.
Tune in Friday, November 27th for a special FSRN documentary, The Rebirth of Segregated Schools.
For Latino students, we have a level of segregation that's really unprecedented.
We'll explore the reasons why students are becoming more racially separated and what it means for the future of U.S. education. That's Friday, November 27th on Free Speech Radio News. Earlier this week, the Sri Lankan government announced that it would begin releasing the estimated 130,000 Tamil refugees it is keeping in government-run camps. That process will begin on December 1st. The camps, which have received international criticism for keeping civilians in poor conditions under armed guards, are scheduled to close completely by the end of January. The camps were built to detain people displaced after the military defeated the Tamil Tiger rebels last May.
Since the conflict ended, the government claims that they are building a united country. But after 30 years of bloody civil war between the Sinhalese and the ethnic Tamils, serious challenges remain on the road to lasting peace. FSRN's Rebecca Henschke reports from Colombo.
Prayers for peace and prosperity are chanted in the courtyard of a Buddhist temple in the center of the capital, Colombo. Worshippers here praise the government for bringing about an end to the 30-year-old civil war.
People is happy. My country is free. No any trouble in anywhere. We can go anywhere. We always have good freedom.
After the loss of thousands of innocent lives, the defeat of the Tamil Tigers has brought Sri Lanka to a crossroads. People like Sinhalese Professor Sarath Kottagama have genuine optimism that lasting peace has finally come.
The way I see it is the key factor is finished. The key elements of agitation that had prevailed is over. What we now have is to see the rehabilitation and reconstruction happening properly. I say the word properly because if we had a problem for 30 years, we need to recognize why and then rectify and change it. So as an educator, the way I had seen it always is that there had been some deprivation of opportunities for the basically the youth, and also partly the youth had been misled.
To address this lack of opportunities for the estimated 12% of the population who are ethnic Tamil, many Sinhalese in the capital say the answer is economic development.
You know, I'm a very firm believer that peace can only come through business, through economic prosperity.
Gahan da Silva runs a large eco-tourism company.
You know, why should somebody take up arms and fight? You know, they'd be, you know, earning a good salary, having a good standard of living, and they'd be more preoccupied with the kind of thing a Western consumer will be. You know, they'd be more interested in, you know, whether they're going to get the latest iPod Nano or the latest iPhone. The emphasis will change to, in a sense, materialism, not sort of, you know, supporting a militant cause or something.
But buying the latest iPhone is far from the mind of mother Mujitvu. In the courtyard of her boarding house near the sea in Colombo, she pulls out a laminated photo of her son from a plastic bag. He went missing in 2008 after he was taken into police custody.
So later on we went to police station and lodged entries, and we went to Manoj's office and lodged entries, and they said they will look for him. And ever since, I have been going for the meetings, but so far I have not found my son.
The meeting she talks about is for the thousands of families like hers at the office of Mano Ganeshan, a Tamil parliamentarian. At the office, his secretary is calling numbers on a long list of the missing families. They're fighting to have their case investigated by the state. Mano Ganeshan says creating an environment of equality and social justice is at the bottom of the list in post-war Sri Lanka.
They have ended the terrorism in this country, but they have not defeated the root causes which paved way for terrorism, paved way for separatism, paved way for Tamil extremism.
The Tamils, he says, were fighting for an identity and to control their own affairs. Such feelings cannot be blotted out by eliminating the Tamil Tiger rebels, he says.
The government has a historic opportunity to address them, but they have missed the bus. So until and unless these root causes are addressed politically, this struggle is going to continue in any form.
He wants to see political power in the form of regional autonomy for the Tamil majority areas, similar to the peace deal in the Aceh province of Indonesia. Gahan Pereira, the director of the Sri Lankan Institute for Peace, argues that this must be a government priority.
The political solution is about giving to Tamil people the sense that they are equal citizens, that they are not discriminated against, and that they can participate in decision-making. I think that last thing that I said, participation, is absolutely crucial.
But many barriers have been erected between Sri Lanka's communities, and special programs to build bridges and regain inter-community trust are urgently required. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Rebecca Henschke in Colombo.
Portland, Oregon has a lot of cafes, but one of them is attracting national attention. That's because it's the first place in the U.S. where medical marijuana patients can consume the drug on site. KBOO's Stephen Camp stopped by for a visit.
Patrons of Rumpspanker's Cannabis Cafe are allowed to smoke marijuana, as long as they don't pay for it. At the door, you need to show three pieces of identification: your state medical marijuana card, a cafe membership, and a state-issued ID. Then you're escorted down the stairs. At the brightly lit bar, no cash changes hands. Patrons choose their bud from the 20 or so mason jars lined up on the wall. All of the marijuana is donated by growers. Madeline Martinez is the executive director of Oregon Normal, a legalization advocacy group that manages the cafe.
One of the things in our law that's unique to Oregon is that we can exchange freely with each other. I can give you as much as I want within the 24 ounces that we're allowed to have. And so people have given this to me to share with the community because they realize that's what we do.
Volunteer bud tenders grind the marijuana and pack it into vaporizers, which use heat and air to extract the psychoactive agents THC and CBD. They say they're thrilled to have this previously unheard of job.
My name is Caroline Birmingham, and I am one of the first three bud tenders. The first night we opened, I was the servant of the bud. I enjoyed it so much. Look at all the smiles in here. Everybody's smiling.
Though everybody here has a signature from their doctor saying they qualify for medical marijuana, the atmosphere is more party than clinic. Martinez says some people have a hard time accepting that.
Most people get very upset to see a disabled person in a wheelchair with a smile on their face. They feel that we should be just glum and you know, it's really sad. You know, we're all social creatures.
Cafe patron Scott Dollins says he's glad he doesn't have to hide anymore.
You know, you can come here and sit and not be bothered by anybody, or, you know, you don't have to hide in your car, sit down in the doctor's office or anything. You can come over here, you know, after your doctor's appointment, and, you know, everything's all right.
The owner of the cafe, Eric Solomon, gave up his liquor license when he switched to a cannabis-friendly business model. He says serving alcohol would be a conflict of interest in a place that's meant for medicine.
But the opportunity to be a nation's first, a one-of-a-kind, doesn't come along every day, so kind of tipped the scales there.
In 2007, Portland's mayor and police chief ordered the police bureau not to investigate activity related to the Medical Marijuana Act. And this year, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder said federal agents would hold off as well. Stephen Camp, FSRN, Portland, Oregon.
And that wraps up today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Today's headlines editor was Nell Abram. Washington, D.C. editor was Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Rose Katapchi and Scott Pham. You can visit us online at fsrn.org. You can send questions, comments, or news tips to comments at fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In New York, I'm Doran Marina.